In episode one of Bearing Up When the Chips Are Down, I was in conversation with ITV's This Morning resident psychologist, Emma Kenny. We discussed human feelings and the emotions in business in a time of crisis. In this episode, I'm in conversation with Professor Vicky Culpin.
Hello, I am Professor Vicky Culpin, and in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about the topic of resilience and why resilience is a really important skill for you to think about in order to navigate this very difficult time.
In future episodes, I will discuss innovating with urgency in a time of crisis with Ron Ashkenaz. And in episode four, I'll be in conversation with the mighty Jim Sullivan, who tells me what it means when he says business, and the hospitality business in particular, must look through the right end of the telescope. Now we're off to Ashridge Executive Business School to meet Professor Vicky Culpin. Vicky Culpin is an author, a podcaster, a TED talker, and professor of organisational behaviour at the world-renowned Ashridge Executive Education Business School in Berkhamsted, Hertfordshire, here in the UK. She works with clients from across the world, teaching leadership development and sharing her extensive research, which often focuses on something that has probably never been so important and relevant as now, and that is the connection between personal well-being and resilience. My first question centres on building personal resilience in uncertain times. But before I ask that, allow me to welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
That was very kind of you to join us. So the only certainty in our sector, the hospitality sector right now, is that it is very, very uncertain. In fact, uncertainty rules. And I would be really interested in your opinion on how listeners to this podcast could improve their resilience and develop their capacity to recover from this situation. In fact, could I be so bold as to say, how could people not only survive, but thrive as well?
I think it's a really important question. And I think there are a number of facets here. But I think first of all, and I think this is more important than anything else, is yes, thriving is fantastic. But for some people, in fact, for an awful lot of people in this sector, just surviving is good enough at the moment. It's extraordinarily difficult. And one of the things we know about resilience is the same macro level event, so the same event, can actually affect people in very, very different ways. So for some people, actually just getting through to the next day and the next day is enough. And what worries me in times like this is as people create a situation where they feel that they need to thrive, that they need to find something that means that they see the good in all this and come together and thrive. And that's fantastic. But actually also it's about not giving yourself such laudable but often unreachable goals. And actually it's for some people, it genuinely is just thinking about how to look after yourself and survive to the next day. So I think that's really important to say, that everybody can kind of give themselves a bit of a break when it is very difficult, because that is absolutely the situation that people are in.
Very interesting perspective, because, you know, in business, you do tend to kind of thrive and strive to go forward. But actually what you're saying is surviving right now is acceptable.
Absolutely. And I think for me, one of the absolute key aspects of resilience is that what keeps me resilient is not the same as what keeps you resilient. It's not the same that keeps my partner resilient, my friends and my family and my team at work. Everybody will have a different reaction to even the same external event, whether it's a positive or a negative one. And so seeing how other people are dealing with it is sometimes a way of actually giving ourselves a really hard time and saying, well, they're really thriving, or they seem to be doing okay. Why am I finding it difficult? And actually, I think it's really important to say that's okay. And if we can just help people get through, then that for some people is enough and is difficult enough for them. Yes, it's fantastic if we can create support and help people and give them tools and ways of thinking that get them beyond just getting through. But sometimes in difficult times, just getting through is enough.
Could you give me a couple of examples of the different things that people may be feeling? Because you talked about that actually some people, certain aspects may affect them and other people that may not. What types of things could people be feeling in a situation like this?
Yeah, so I mean, for example, if we just take the general, you know, pandemic, the situation, for some people, they might find that, you know, spending more time at home, spending more time with their family, reducing their commute or having no commute at all, reduced working hours. These kinds of things may, for some people, be perceived as positive. More time with family, fantastic. No commute, great. I've got more time for exercise. I feel more in control. And for some people, it's the perfect storm. It's extraordinarily difficult. More time with my family creates difficulties. We don't have enough space. I don't have my commute anymore. So I don't have that break from work and home. I don't have the headspace. I can't exercise because I can't access the gym. So we all bring to every situation our background, our personality, our own experiences, our own way of viewing the world. And so what it means is for some people, the same situation can be very energizing and we can feel very in control. For other people, exactly the same situation can mean we feel very out of control. And control is so important for resilience.
What I've been doing by research for our conversation today, I've seen an acronym that you use called VUCA. And I see that it means volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous. And a time of VUCA right now. How do leaders in particular, and that could be a leader, the main leader of the company, or it could be somebody who is a shift runner in a pub, for example, or a head chef. Mm-hmm. But how do leaders lead through a period like this? And are there any skills that they particularly need to focus on or hone up on?
I think the first thing here is to say that operating, whether you're a leader of thousands or have a team of one or two, some of those challenges are exactly the same. Leaders often believe themselves, and followers of those leaders often feel that the role of the leader is to have the answers. So that we look to a leader, particularly in difficult times, to have a direction and to have an answer. And if they don't have an answer, they have the resources to get an answer at some point. And of course, at the moment, the reality is that we genuinely don't know. We can make prediction after prediction after prediction. We can be optimistic or pessimistic, but there is a huge unknown. And for a leader, that's really difficult because possibly for the first time in their professional life, they are in a situation where they don't know and it is impossible almost to get the information to know. And that's really draining on an individual's resilience, both for the leader and for the team, of course, for the followers. So I think there's the most important point is to accept and to allow yourself to understand that actually as a leader at the moment, you don't have the answers. I often say, you know, this is the first pandemic you've ever experienced. So why would you expect to have the answers? So that's the first thing. And also to understand actually that leadership at the moment is less probably about having the answers and more about the softer skills around empathy, around listening, around creating a space so that your team or teams are able to share how they're feeling, the ability to stand in somebody else's shoes as a leader to say, I feel like this, but that isn't necessarily how somebody else feels. So how might they feel? How might they be perceiving it? So that acceptance that your leadership may not be what it used to be, and actually the ability to listen and create a space and work with your team, often in quite a different way, might be the way forward.
Actually, that links into one of your models, the circle of control. I can see how this works in both a business situation and personal situation. Could you explain the principles behind the circle of control?
Absolutely. So if people who are listening to this think about what happens to them when they're under a huge amount of pressure and stress, often, not always, but often one of the things we feel is out of control. Things in our environment feel out of control. Now, that might be true. But more often than not, a lot of those things that feel out of control actually haven't changed. It's just that we feel that lack of control. It's a perception, not necessarily a reality. Of course, some of the things may be out of control, but often not as much as actually is the reality. It's just our view of the world. And one of the things I think is really important when we feel like that is to focus on those things that we actually can control. So we feel that we are in a position where some things we can control. We also then can let our thinking and our cognition and our emotions, we can let go of the things we can't control. Now, when we're really positively resourced and we've got lots of space and lots of energy, we've got the capacity to worry about big global issues and things we can't control. But when we're under a huge amount of pressure and stress and we don't have that spare resource, worrying about those big global issues means that we don't have enough resource for other things. So it isn't about stop worrying about the big stuff, but actually when we're really, really under-resourced and tired and fatigued and under pressure and stress, focusing our energies on things we can control and influence is actually really helpful. It makes us feel more in control. It enables us to ignore, albeit for a short time, things we can't control. And that sense of regaining control is actually really, really helpful, particularly for individuals in organizations who may have less control than others. Leaders often have a lot more control. People lower down in the organization have less control. So it actually becomes even more important for them.
We touched on the problems, including home life and work life boundary clashes a little while ago. And because a lot of people, you know, HR teams, marketing teams, operations managers to an extent will find themselves working from home. And you know, we touched on the boundary clashes, but how would you advise people to prevent these things from happening?
So fundamentally, it is about choice. There are lots of things we haven't been able to choose in these situations. And of course, that's understandable. But there will be some things within your working and personal life you're able to make choices on. And that's the first thing is to stop and think, am I actively choosing to let my work life and my home life bleed into one? And does that work for me? Because it absolutely isn't one size fits all. Some people prefer to do their emails at the weekend so that they don't hit a wall of emails on a Monday. If that's an active choice and it helps you in your resilience, then there is no one size fits all. So it's about stopping and thinking about what works for me. But some of the things that you can do to kind of create a slightly artificial but structured working day is, and there are a few things you can try. So for example, if you used to have a commute, and a commute is often a really great way of signaling the end of home life and the start of a working day. If you used to have a commute, then maybe if it's safe to do so, literally leave the house or your flat and walk for 10 minutes, or even drive for 10 minutes, something that signals the start of the working day. Another thing is, you know, a lot of people thought, great, working from home, I can wear casual clothes, I can wear my tracksuit, I don't need to put a shirt and tie on. But again, sometimes dressing for work is a signal that it's the start of the working day. If we don't do that, we then, when we get to the end of the day, we don't have that signal to relax, because we've not had that shift from more formal clothing to less formal clothing. So again, something it might be worth trying is, can you actually change what you wear for a working day to a non-working day to signal that? Another thing you can try, and again, I appreciate that often this is very difficult because people are working from home in whatever space they can find. But if you have any choice at all, try not to work in a space which is this you use for relaxing, particularly the bedroom. Now, I appreciate from a pragmatic point of view, for a lot of people, they have no choice. But if you do, then actually the problem with working in the bedroom is you associate that space with work and not rest. And so that can actually impact your ability to rest and to sleep as well. So I guess what I'm saying is, are there structural, functional things you can do within your working day that signal to your brain that this is work versus play, this is work versus rest? The more that you can do that, the more helpful it is to kind of separate the two out.
Some of those things that you've suggested are so simple, but I could see quite clearly how they would work, that just that change from work clothes to casual clothes, or just going out for a walk to sort of say, right, the day has ended, or the day is just about to start. So that is good. And you touched on sleep, actually. Now, when I was looking through a TED talk that you gave in 2018, it was called A Wake Up Call, This Talk Should Send You to Sleep. And you talked about sleep quite a lot, but at one point I was shocked, Vicky. Yes, I was shocked. You stood in front of you were on a stage in front of a couple of hundred people, and you grabbed a bottle of red wine. You poured a glass, you drank it down, and then you poured another one, and you drank that down as well. But of course, it was all in the name of illustrating your point, I hastened to add. Now, people in the hospitality industry have been known to take a drink or two. And I was just wondering, with this in mind, if you could explain the point that you were trying to illustrate.
Absolutely. So first, I should say that anybody listening is slightly concerned about my welfare. That was blackcurrant juice, not red wine. I think if I drank two glasses of red wine that quickly, the TED talk would not have ended well. But the point is very simple, and that is that often people struggle to understand the impact of poor sleep because we find a myriad of reasons to explain why we're feeling unwell, why I'm feeling fatigued, why I can't concentrate, why I can't regulate my mood very well, why I'm a bit tearful or a bit angry, why I'm catching coughs and colds. We always can explain these things, and often we don't think about sleep. The analogy to alcohol is a really useful one because actually, if we think about how we feel when we've had two or three glasses of wine, that inability to regulate our mood, that inability to have good decisions, that inability to be particularly effective cognitively, that inability to drive safely, those things are mirrored in the impact of poor sleep. So I use it as an example because often it is something that people can easily draw to mind. How do I feel and how do I behave when I'm drunk? And actually, there's some really strong similarities between that and being tired. In fact, there's quite a famous study now that looked at the effect of alcohol and compared it to the effect of poor sleep on speed of processing, so how quickly we make decisions and those kind of cognitive things. And they found that staying awake for 17 hours, which is a long day at work for most of us, so 17 hours of wakefulness can be the equivalent on our behavior as having a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05%. 24 hours of a wakefulness can be the equivalent of 0.1%. And to put that in context, the drink driving limit in England and Wales is 0.08% and in Scotland is 0.05%. So actually we're close to, if not at, the drink driving limit in terms of our behaviour if we're staying awake for long periods of time.
So it's pretty clear that sleep is extremely important. And if you don't get enough sleep, the consequences are that your decision making is not going to be as good, especially at a time when you need to be making really, really good decisions.
Absolutely. And possibly even more interesting is one of the things we now know about good quality and quantity of sleep is it helps our mood. When we are tired, overtired, not getting the right amount of sleep or the right quality of sleep, often we have a negative view of the world. We have a negative bias. We tend to remember negative events but forget positive events. We can't regulate our mood very well. So what's already a difficult situation feels even more difficult if it's compounded by tiredness.
We talked, Vicky, about thriving and surviving and the difference between the two. How do you feel that people who handle this crisis well and listen to some of the points that you've spoken about here, how do you think they are going to appear the other side of this pandemic?
Firstly, I would say get people to think about what they mean by handling it well. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to my earlier point around for some people, handling it well is getting through. So getting to the other side of this. For other people, handling it well will be still having an intact relationship, still having a job, still having a team, still having something they care about. So I think what's really important in this field is everybody is so different. What builds some people's resilience can drain other people's resilience. And that's why having conversations and talking to each other is really important, because my view of the world is very different than another person's view of the world. So I think people who handle this well, I think fundamentally is what well looks like for one person will be very different than what well looks like for somebody else.
So I actually fell into that trap a little bit there, didn't I?
Yes.
Yeah. See, I must listen to this podcast. If you were to summarise all the answers that you've given in a sentence or two, a sort of precis that listeners could ruminate on, what do you think you would say?
I think I'd say three things. I think firstly is resilience is individual. What builds and depletes your resilience is not the same as for other people. And that relates to my second point, which is getting through can be enough. Don't compare yourself to others, which relates to the third point, which is talk. Communicate, communicate, communicate to other people that you're close to in your family and friends, to your colleagues. Because the more that you talk, the more support you'll get, but also it will help you realise that everybody is different and everybody will be struggling with different things.
Your book, The Business of Sleep is published by Bloomsbury and is available in all the right places. I was reading the reviews, actually, and there was one review. I don't know if you've read this, Vicky. It says, a salutary reminder that with all our striving to achieve, we often overlook the simplest means to maximise our potential, which is to get a bit of decent kip. Where else can people hear, see you, or read your work?
As you said, there are a couple of TEDx talks that people can access. I think if you just go online and look for myself under Ashridge Executive Education, there is a variety of blogs, as you said, the books, some TEDx talks, various bits and pieces there. And of course, if people are interested, then to drop me an email, that's no problem at all.
Brilliant. Yes, just so that listeners can go and seek out that TED talk, it's called A Wake-Up Call, This Talk Should Send You to Sleep. Professor Vicky Culpin, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That was Professor Vicky Culpin from Ashridge Executive Business School. The podcast is advert-free, sponsorship-free, and is funded in its entirety by me, Elton Mooner. To put it quite simply, I've had a long and rewarding career in the hospitality industry, and assembling the experts and producing Bearing Up When the Chips Are Down is my way of giving something back to an industry that has served me well at a time when the people in the industry could really do with a helping hand. Please press subscribe to this podcast if you like it. Do listen to the other three episodes of Bearing Up When the Chips Are Down. And if the chips are down for you and you fancy a chat, on a strictly no charge whatsoever, trouble shared is a troubled halved basis. You can find me on LinkedIn.